You know, you feel a kinship to other Curse franchises when you see bad things happen to other organizations and go, feels familiar. I know that feeling. I too understand what that is like. Poor Minnesota Vikings fans. I disrespected you recently when I did my top 10 loser franchises. I didn't put the Minnesota Vikings in there, and man, the Minnesota Vikings fan spoke. I said, you guys had AP, and in my life, you've actually had moments, you know? You've had it together. Are you a top 10 choker franchise? For sure. But a loser franchise is just, it's been too much competency. Even this year, like, I'll get into it, but I like your coach and got Jefferson. How can you be the biggest losers when you have the best, like maybe the best player in the NFL? There's just too much baseline competency, even though they are losers in the sense that they never win. But this offseason may tip the scales. Your season's over before it began. It's done. And not that you were going to win with a rookie quarterback. Like, that was very unlikely. But, yeah, Addison gets carted off. You already lost the starting cornerback to a torn ACL. Your star tied out and is out for months. And then this ends up happening to you. You lose your rookie quarterback who makes a beautiful throw in the preseason. And again, it's the preseason, okay? We all overreact to it. We overreact to the first few months of the NFL season. It's kind of dumb how we learn our lesson every single year with it. Is through week 4, we start doing MVP rankings in the NFL. And then by week 12, we go, oh, remember that narrative? And you go, right, that was bad. That didn't really work out. We think it makes more sense to do because it's a week-to-week league and there's so much downtime to do it and every game means more than every other league. But then, yeah, at the end of it, you know, you kind of can usually throw it a lot from the first month. But, yeah, losing an exciting rookie quarterback, the first one, it sucks. But where I get the Leafs parallel is that I see the number 1967 and it immediately triggers me. And it reminds me of how cursed the Leafs are and that, you know, you're right there, brothers in arms with Minnesota Vikings. But yeah, J.J. McCarthy, first quarterback drafted in the first round to miss his entire rookie season since 1967. Cursed year. I tried to find more cursy things about 67 and build it out into an entire segment, but there wasn't enough. The only thing that bothers me is that the World Cup falls on even years because England last won its World Cup in 1966. And it's just so cool. The Leafs England parallel is my favorite one. And it's just, yeah. Although I actually think that more people root for England than they do the Leafs, like casuals. They would go, hey, you know what? England won. That's nice. What's crazy is, you know, without England, we're all wearing lederhosen. And yet we all hate England. It doesn't make any sense. They're the heroes in every single war movie we ever grew up on. And then whenever they play soccer, we just see them as hooligans who throw beer. And we're like, we hate these guys more than anybody. God, I hate England. How could you not hate England? Anyways, there's a couple things I missed from yesterday. Because I did the post-media, whatever, podcast. It's up on Leafs Talk feed. Please subscribe to that podcast. Please follow that podcast. Do all those things. This one, too. It always really helps. Any opportunity I get to ask, I'm always going to do it because it's that meaningful. But then I missed the side stuff because Shanahan was there and Berube was there and Marner was there and Riley was there. And did Marner speak? I didn't see anything from Marner. He did, eh? So anyway, I just didn't see anything from it, which is actually pretty shocking considering what my Twitter feed is like, what my circle of friends is like, the fact that I'm in media and this happened and I saw all the other guys. So strange. Anyway, there were a couple things that were said about Tavares and Matthews yesterday that I actually thought were a lot more insightful than what we got from Tavares and Matthews and Brad Treliving, because those guys, when they first got trotted out there, It felt a little awkward. It's one thing that I didn't really hit on is Treliving was trying to kind of make the dad jokes and, you know, oh, it's so bright and I can't see you. Oh, shucks. He was doing that routine and you're like, okay. And then Tavares and Matthews. Tavares has the signed statement or the prepared statement and sending it over to Matthews, who looks excited but can't really muscle out too much because it's a tough situation for him. He can't be too excited knowing that it's a tough day for Tavares. It's not your normal captaincy day. But when these other guys ended up getting their media availabilities, I thought that out of the limelight of being in front of the center stage, there was a couple of things that were said that made me reflect on it just a little bit more. And so I just do a little bit of housekeeping today. The first thing I just want to say about it is I actually commend the Tavares move more the more I think about it, because it really does seem obvious to a lot of people. And yes, of course, this was the right move. No one can really debate that. I think if you're trying to downplay Matthews getting the captaincy, you're just being a contrarian to be a contrarian. You're probably someone where people don't even like bringing stuff to you because you just immediately are like, well, actually, and you go, why did I even mention a thing? It's actually kind of like my producer, Mike Jose, is he needs to learn how to do that. Cause it's like, hey man, here's a cool thing. And then he goes, yeah, here's why. And he's like, oh, he ruins it immediately. And so you go, you know what? Never mind. You know what? Next time, never mind. Tavares sacrificed a lot. This is a guy, again, who has put everything in his life into hockey and family, but this is a hockey player. Dyed in the wool, just grew up in a family of athletes and athletics, went on to be someone that Maple Leaf fans wanted before he was eligible to be drafted, is someone that this city dreamed on. But for him, again, a guy that was scoring goals at every single level all the way up, his teams. If you played a team with John Tavares' team, you didn't call it by any other name until recently. And whatever, you know, but to get to a spot like that, you probably have to have an ego. That is somewhere in you, even for humble guys, even for someone like him who doesn't come off as, you know, a diva wide receiver or a volume shooter on an NBA team, right? It doesn't come off the same way, but either way, it's clearly in him, that massive drive. And when he brought up the statement, we went over it a little bit yesterday during the Leafs talk, but the thing that I think is a little bit more meaningful, if you're trying to, you know, squeeze anything out of this, he made a genuine sacrifice. And this is a team that has been criticized over and over and over again for guys not making sacrifices. And it's not just the financial sacrifices. Last year, it was playoff sacrifices. Whether it was people questioning how much somebody could have played through something or, you know, avoiding finishing checks in corners, right? Not enough sacrifice has been made with this team. And for John Tavares to do this, I actually think that it's his greatest move as captain from a leadership standpoint. It's the first time there's been a meaningful, consequential, you cannot deny it, sacrifice. And I thought about this more and more, like listening to those little segments, those little snippets from one of his teammates and from his, you know, president, because the guy used to play, you know, you're reminded of that when he stands next to these guys, Brendan Shanahan, he's like hulking and you go, whoa, right. You beat up Jerome Iginla badly. You were tough. Probably still are, actually. Brendan Shanahan can say a lot of things. Probably still pretty damn tough. Probably still punch your lights out with ease, with relative ease. I think, you know, me and my friends, we do this test where we call it the poison booth. That's when you see color analyst with the play-by-play guy, and you say, if the booth started to fill with poison, how long would the color analyst, would it take for him to kill the play-by-play guy? And it's like, you know, you set the over-under at the time. I think my poison booth time with Brendan Shanahan would be 13 seconds. I think that's like that's how long it would take for him to kill me in a confined space. Like, obviously, pretty tough guy. Still a very, very tough guy. Anyways, I wanted to play a couple of these clips because, yes, they did remind me of what this is. And then I want to talk about a little bit of the reverb off of it. Anyways, let's play Morgan Riley first.
I think it speaks volumes about who John is as a person and where his priorities lie. I think for him, the only thing that really matters is our team and the results that we're able to get during the season. And you know, what's best for our group. And I mean, I think you're right. I think that, you know, when this this came about, I'm sure that there were some challenges there for him. But I think he's handled everything like the class act that he is. And you know, I had a chance to speak with him, and you know, I think the first thing that I felt was just, you know, how well he's handling it, and you know, his view on things. And so as this has kind of come about, you know, I think he's been outstanding. And but that's no surprise to anyone. You know, that's how he operates. So you know, I think Austin's fortunate to have that relationship with John. As I mean, and as a team, we're extremely fortunate to have the two of them working together.
So this is the biggest takeaway for me when it comes to DeVar's thing. We're talking about his legacy and how it could be difficult. And for those of us on the outside of this, it's harder to, I think, understand than it is for people that are inside of it, who work their asses off to get that honor, where they go, man, this is a real signifier of where you're at in your career and who you are in the league. And to lose it, you know that people are going to talk about your game and where you're at and what your legacy is while you're still playing it, while you're still in that, what you consider to be the peak. And that does have to be tough. And listening to Riley speak there, one of the guys who I think is probably now, it used to be Muzzin, but now I think he is the most honest and genuine window into the psyche of the Leafs team on a whole. I think he's really well-spoken. I think he's pretty thoughtful. And he doesn't hold back as much. And maybe part of it is that just the kind of guy he is. Maybe part of it is that he was here before it seemed to get so bogged down in the corporate speak, like before this team got that level of you're not getting anything out of them. But Riley's really good at it. He's a good speaker, and I think that there's an honesty to him that is a little bit different from other players in the league, and certainly other players right now that are on this team. And yeah, hearing him say that, I think that one of the coolest things for Tavares moving forward, and one of the things that I would tell him is, I think that your teammates who may have not bought into you as the rah-rah leader, maybe you weren't the guy that they followed or wanted to follow into the foxhole, are more willing to do it after seeing this, that there is going to be more of a rallying around you of the people that matter because of this selfless act. And that hopefully part of this legacy is that a couple of your teammates are going to take note and end up doing the same thing. Maybe it's wishful thinking. Maybe it's gleaning too much from it. But I think that there's actually I know when I see that from my leaders, that it has an impact. When you see somebody sacrifice for the greater good, it's hard to ignore. Anyways, here's Shanahan's clip on John, because this one resonated with me too.
Can you not just how difficult it would have been for him to have to stand out there and do what he did today? I mean, including that many.
I disagree. I think that John's a cerebral guy, and John saw it and understood it as well as we did, that the time was right. And John, you know, I've known the Tavares family from his uncle in lacrosse days, and I know what they're made of and the kind of team players that they are. And they always are thinking about what's best for the team. So I wasn't surprised at all to see, like, John embracing the idea and concept. And as he said, he has one goal here. And anything that he thinks that can help pull the team further along, you know, he wants to do. So I think that John is a unique individual and wanted to be a part of that, and wanted to certainly certainly help Austin along the way as well.
And that's it. And that's a great way to summarize who John Tavares was as captain of this team. Was it disappointing tenure? Yes. Were there moments where, you know, you rolled your eyes because it was hockey cliches and low energy, monotone? Yes. You know, it was. It's just that it's a big part of it. Did he deliver on what was going to be a promise that seemed to be made when it was three talented young pieces that this team had not seen in the salary cap era, or hell, the post six hockey team era? Yes. Yes. A lot of failing, this was not great accomplishments, a lot of it. No. But the thing we always heard about John Tavares' leadership style was lead by example. And I think it speaks to him a little bit that a lot of us that discussed this and a lot of us that looked at it kind of did think, hey, this is sort of a given. And yes, it's happened in hockey before. And yes, there have been other guys. And this is like, you know, a little bit of Leafs just over, I'm trying to think of a word that wasn't inappropriate because that was the where I was at with it, is a little too much credit for the Leafs, let's say. Too much credit. Yeah, probably. Man, I'm doing a Leafs show. Anyways, I think that it was what John Tavares' career in some ways had been leading towards with all the lead by example stuff. And the fact that, yes, he did look up to his uncle, who was a dominant scorer and someone who, is an all-time legend in lacrosse to the point where, you know, you might know who he is and I know who he is. But all of that kind of training for the team ended up being really important at this juncture as, you know, it's a group that has failed and is in the spotlight with a big media market. And you listen to the way that these guys spoke yesterday, and it's tough because, again, they don't want to sound like they're disparaging Don Tavares. But a lot of us, or at least for me anyways, missed how big of a deal this loss was for him because he is such a sacrifice guy and because he has been such a lead by example kind of dude that it just sort of felt obvious. And I don't know if there's as many players and that are going to be even coming forward now that are going to be quite like that. Anyways, other quick things. One, I thought that the stuff that I was asking for, by the way, Elliot Freeman on 32 Thoughts, which he did a surprise summer pod. It's up on all the feeds. But he also mentioned that, yeah, the extension has been discussed, and it's something both sides are considering, but that, yeah, it wasn't going to be brought up yesterday at all because they didn't want to overshadow the Matthews stuff, which is obvious. But, yeah, I do think, and now this is me speaking, I think that yesterday, the way that all of that happened made it a near certainty that John Tavares is going to be extended as a Maple Leaf. Like, I at this point, I would be blown away. And I always believed he was going to stay here and that this is where he was going to be. He set up roots here. He's got a house here. This is where his family is. He came here in the first place. I don't think that he's chasing money. He's chasing legacy and comfort. He's got a ton of money. He's happy here. He's now going to be more liked here. He's going to be more revered by his teammates here. It makes too much sense. But now I think that he and the organization have clearly established that they're on the same page and that this is a relationship that's going to continue moving forward. But yeah, the other quick things I mentioned, I think that Berube and Shanahan both actually hit on why Matthews is the guy and what I actually think is basically the entire thing with captaincies going forward in terms of tangible stuff. So here's Berube.
Sorry, well, what you learned about Austin, what do you think is going to make him be a great captain?
Influence, you know.
Pause.
Obviously his...
Pause. I could have just played that. Influence. He has influence. And then I'm going to play the rest of the answer because he kind of does try to couch it with the stuff of like compliments to Tavares, right? But this was the problem with yesterday in terms of not being able to get all the stuff, the positive stuff to say about Matthews. Because everything that you would say about him would seem in contrast like those are the things that John doesn't have. But that is it. That is the reason why he is the captain over John Tavares. More so than the skill, more so than, you know, anything else, is that there is a magnetism to Austin Matthews where every group of friends has this guy where your group of friends might be doing something and you go, I don't know who's going. And then there's the one person and you go, oh, okay. Yeah, I'll go. You got the one group guy who's like, yeah, I'm going to go. Hey, he rallies the boys. He rallies the people and says, yeah, I'm doing it. And you're like, ah, damn. All right. I guess I will go. This seemed a little scary and intimidating, but that guy's going. So I guess we'll do that. And Matthews is that dude on the Leafs. And plain and simple, most of this captaincy is not about the jersey sales. And yeah, is that nice little bonus peak? Sure, I'm sure it is. Even though I do think that they should just put the C on the sweaters. Like if you want to bring it into a team shop for, if you're a team of a, or you're a fan of a team that hasn't won since 1967 and you pay a lot of money for all of your Leafs merch and you support them with expensive tickets and blah, 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 blah. I think if you have a Matthews sweater and it doesn't have a C on it, that the team should just, they should hook you up. They should hook you up with that little patch. That would be nice. Anyway, let's play the rest of Berube.
Influence, you know, obviously his
great player he is, but it's his work ethic off the ice and what he, how he prepares day in and day out. He's at an elite level, in my opinion, in that department. You know, I've witnessed it firsthand, constantly working, trying to get better. He's a team-first guy. You know, he's the type of guy that's going to take care of his teammates like John Tavares did, and that's what makes a good captain.
Everything he said after influence, if that was all it was about Matthews, Tavares would still be captain. Every single thing he mentioned there is a John Tavares trait. They're actually all the traits that we heard when Tavares was named captain. But the one that was missing was influence. And that's why, after he said it, that's why it was the first thing that came to mind, even for a guy that hasn't been here, who's getting to know these dudes over Zoom calls. It's like, he knows it. And the whole league knows it. And you know it too. Anyways, here's Shanahan also kind of saying the same thing.
Something on the outside we don't see about what else Matthews does.
Well, there's lots of things you could describe, but I think the intangible that was alluded to today is, you know, he has the ability that people want to follow him. And not that John didn't have that, but Austin, we're now drafting players that had posters of Austin Matthews up on their wall when they were little kids. So Austin has that ability that he is, it's not something that he has worked on. It's just something he was born with. People want to follow him and are drawn to him. I think giving him this time and this runway up until this point of his career and not putting that kind of pressure on him as an 18-year-old and allowing him to, like, watch some of the leaders that have been here in front of him has helped get to this point where he's evolved, where he's ready to do this.
That's it. They said it. People want to follow him and are drawn to him. That's influence. That's why he's the captain of the Maple Leafs. Plain and simple. It's not the skill. It's not the work ethic. Those things are all great. It's not the competitive drive. Those are some of the reasons why he wanted to have this honor bestowed upon him. But the tangible thing that might have an impact, if there is anything from a on-the-ice this season perspective, is that. And moving forward, is again, you know who you're getting your orders from. You know who you want to impress. It's the guy with the influence, and now it's the guy with the C. Anyway, one last thing from yesterday, and this is sort of a throwaway thing. This has nothing to do with the captaincy. But they asked, everything with the Leafs is framed through the question of, how does this help you win? How does this get you the cup, right? This is what I've been doing, this segment. It's about winning. Otherwise, who cares? All of it is done through that lens, kind of to a annoying degree, right? Because sometimes you can't even enjoy the small moments and I don't blame anybody for it. Again, there's been no winning since 1967, and there's been a lot of resources, a lot of opportunities, like things have been squandered here. And I think that there's people that are directly responsible for some of those things, culture setters, whatever you want to go through it. It's been a tough go. So whenever people go, I'm never really going to tell you, or I don't really want to tell you, I shouldn't say I never will, because sometimes you gotta, but I don't really want to tell you how to fan. But anyways, they asked Berube about how they're going, or how this is going to impact getting to the Stanley Cup or something along those lines.
It's a process to get to the top of the mountain. I'm not going to comment on getting to the top of the mountain. You know, it's a process from training camp on, and Austin's going to learn on the way too, you know, and he has learned a lot from John Tavares, obviously, and other leaders in this organization that they've had. And, you know, he just needs to be himself and go and play at a high level like he does. And obviously there's other things, being the captain now, that you got to take care of and things like that. But those are all things that we'll talk about.
It's interesting that a coach that was hired because he has won a Stanley Cup, and there are other factors, I know, but that's the main thing that's in the lead of his resume as a coach. One Stanley Cup. He doesn't want to talk at all about the Stanley Cup. And not every organization does this, because you'd be going, this isn't a novel thing. He's not reinventing the wheel. A lot of coaches, they do the one day at a time, control what you can control, one step, 1 foot in front of the other, you know, walk before you can run, that kind of thinking when it comes to building a team out for an entire season. Not novel, but there are groups like, look at the Buffalo Bills last year, for example. They showed up to training camp and they had banners in their facility with the eyes on the Lombardi. It was like a visor with a Lombardi in their sights, because that was the goal, is winning the Super Bowl. I don't think these Leafs players need any more reminding of that. I don't think that they need any more all-ins, because that's what it's been here for the last couple of seasons. It's all in. It's all in. Nobody cares until the playoffs. Stanley Cup, Stanley Cup, Stanley Cup. And guess what? It's going to continue to be that way, largely from a narrative standpoint. Most fans, a lot of media members, it's going to be driven around, hey, how does this help them win? How does this help them get over that hump? Because we've been through enough. We've been through enough regular seasons. It's the same core. People want to see them take that step. Otherwise, you know, you're guilty until you do that. You need to show your bona fides, because people threw flowers at your feet and they praised you and you got the keys to the city before you accomplished anything. You got the money, you got the praise, you got the adulation, all of it. And then nothing was delivered in the most important time of the season. Everyone's aware of it now. I like that this guy was brought in here to, again, bring Stanley Cup experience and to help them get over that hump, to help them evolve as a team. But that the tact, immediately you can see this being a little different. And again, if we're just looking for clues, which is all we're trying to do here, it's the middle of summer, I understand. But if I'm looking for things that are going to be somewhat meaningful for me, when I was listening to all of this stuff yesterday, Greg Berube talking about how he is going to do a good job, I think, hopefully, of shielding these guys from the constant narrative of cup, 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 and just let them play out this season and not have that be a major detractor, focus, or pressure point. Because frankly, the all-in season, the, you know, Amazon's following you around because you must win the cup this year. If you do not win the cup this year, everyone will be fired. Everyone will be traded. Now the threats are kind of hollow and empty anyways, because the only guy that left was Kyle Dubas. And the only reason that he did leave is because he overplayed his hand in a negotiation. Wasn't even like, well, it's like power struggle and overplayed his hand and he lost the power struggle. Wasn't even really accountability. He won the one playoff round and everyone went, extend! It really was that. Nobody's moved on. What? The accountability was Michael Bunting not getting a big contract instead? Like, who was the accountable party here? Like, what is the Samsonov hitting free agency? Like, who's been held accountable? Anyway, I just think it's a kind of a nice, refreshing tone from their coach that it isn't maybe going to feel that way, which every day is. These are the habits that are going to make us win a cup. This is the thing that's going to make us win a cup. This is the all or nothing. That this guy seems to be taking the tact of, yeah, you know, I'm not going to discuss how a captaincy affects winning a Stanley Cup. It's just too far. Not everything needs to be done through that framework. And I think it's going to be great if he's able to maintain some consistency on that. He's also not someone, you know, I mentioned Sheldon Keefe made my job easier. A media conference like that, where you're watching Berube speak and he's giving an answer like that, yeah, I think he's going to make it a little bit harder. Anyways, subscribe to this podcast, leave 5 stars. Again, always helps me out. Follow on Twitter and Instagram at JD Bunkus. Reach out anytime. Take a quick break. Hit what we missed.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
So before I do what we missed, just got to say, I know we wrote off the Blue Jays season because they're done. We were all looking forward to the deadline. What would they trade? How much should they trade? It dominated all of the discourse. Vladdy's contract extension became a bit of a talking point, and he was playing better, and we went, oh, look at Vladdy go. But he's also playing better as George Springer was starting to play better. And again, it was during a very lully period of the Blue Jays season. And I came on and I said, hey, the Blue Jays are now worth watching again. And I look like an idiot because I think the next day or the next that night, the pod came out, they got smacked and embarrassed to like a, even in this season, unprecedented tune. I went, oh, that was poorly timed. It's poorly timed to have the Jays lose like 14-2. Yikes. but it's true. The Jays are watchable because of Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And in fact, I would say that you kind of have to watch the Blue Jays right now because of what Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is doing. He's having the best stretch of his career, like flat out. And, you know, even if you take out the ballpark effects of being in Buffalo and doing all or Florida and all these weird stadiums that he got to play in the COVID year and all of the asterisks that we give that, whether it's crowd and pressure and blah, 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 blah. He's putting together the best stretch of his career since the All-Star break. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. now he's Barry Bonds. And it's like, I know they're playing the Angels and it's at 9:40 at night and not a lot of people are watching this, but it's like impossible to get this guy out. It is now the feeling of whenever anybody gets on base in front of him, when, you know, Varsho steals a hit, and although big home run from Varsho yesterday, anybody gets on, you extend the inning. You accidentally walk the nine hitter and you know Vladdy's coming to the dish. It's like those runs are coming home. He is in dominant territory right now. He's hit, again, since the All-Star break, he's hitting .457. Let that sink in. Doing pretty damn good. He is destroying baseballs. You go and you look at his rolling WRC plus, and the last 25 games have been the best of his career. It's just a huge monster graph. I just saw Jonah Birenbaum. He posted on Twitter that if you look at all-time second halves, all-time in all of baseball, right? Again, tons of time. If Vladdy stays at this pace, which would require him to go a lot more, like pretty much double. You'd have to double this. But right now, in the second half, his OPS is higher than anybody else in baseball history. Higher than Barry Bonds, higher than Ted Williams. It's all Barry Bonds. Higher than Aaron Judge, higher than Babe Ruth. That's the company that he's in right now. So, yeah, it's kind of must-see TV. Like, you throw him a lazy breaking ball, he's putting it on the moon. Anyway, it's been spectacular to watch Vladimir Guerrero Jr. lately. It truly is. It's like, it's awe-inspiring stuff. And frankly, it's keeping me attached to watching the Blue Jays more than anything else, more than the tanking, more than whatever. It's just that the story of the season is going to be, can this guy maintain this? And what does that end up doing for his contract? Did the Jays actually miss a window of opportunity in signing this guy by trying to elongate this process? Was it ever a possibility? He said he was always willing to go to the table with it. But yeah, it's like we did this whole thing about, oh, well, he's a first baseman and you can't pay those guys too much. And look at what other guys have gotten. I think I compared him to Matt Olson recently. And I've always known there was going to be a premium because of his name and because of his ability and because of that 2020 season, but yeah, the 2021 season, but this is better. This is better than what he's done. It's insane what he's doing right now. Insane. .957 slug since the All-Star break. So he's hitting .457 and it's with power. Insane power. Best hitter in baseball since the All-Star break. Like, well, yeah, best player in baseball history. I kind of made that clear. But it's just, yeah, you're watching Aaron Judge hit the 300 club and going, wow, look at Vladdy has that feel right now. Vladdy has that feel. He looks like he's touching that potential. And yeah, it's pretty clear that it was always going to be a number with a three. Like it was always going to be a number with a three, and it's going to look kind of foolish and it's going to be kind of tough when we were like comparing him to Matt Olson like I was. Anyway, Mike Jose, what did we miss?
All right. So New Orleans head coach Dennis Allen, listen, you could take this as he's just super locked into football or he might be an idiot. But basically a reporter.
You have a clip?
I do have the clip.
Yeah, just play the clip.
All right.
Yeah, I'm going to leave the metaphors to you guys.
Thanks.
All right. But what is a metaphor?
What's that?
What is a metaphor? Like, what's the official definition of metaphor?
A metaphor is like using something as comparison as like an example, right?
Okay. All right. I got it.
Yeah, so he was asked what a particular metaphor would be for his Saints squad, and he had no idea what a metaphor was.
I don't know if he had no idea. It sounds like he's trying to be like, I'm just a folksy old football coach, and y'all are the riders, and I'm just here doing my best to make these boys into men. Like, I just want these to be good citizens. But more important than football is that they're good people. He's trying to do one of those, like a whimsical coach, and you go, nah, you sound dumb. You sound really dumb. Here's the thing. If you don't know what a metaphor is, don't ask if you're over grade eight. I think grade eight is the end of you getting to ask what that is without Google. Like, now we have Google. Go be dumb in the shadows and just, like, fire off into a corner somewhere and be like, yeah, that's what I thought it was. That's what I thought it was. You know, listen, I don't think that Saints fans love Dennis Allen. I think that if there was, like, a first coach to be fired odds, I'm guessing he's number one.
They were ripping him for this, too.
No, who was?
Saints fans.
Well, yeah, of course, because Saints fans hate him. Like, he's not liked by Saints fans. What do they like about Dennis Allen? Like, what has he accomplished as the head coach? You went from Sean Payton to Dennis Allen. Yeah, obviously you hate him. Duh. Yeah, they were ripping him for that? No kidding. Yeah, no, they didn't take it as the folksy, likable thing. Yeah, if I was a fan of a team, I wouldn't want my NFL coach trying to put it out there that he doesn't have, like, yeah, grade eight education. I don't think that's, like, a strong suit to have. I do think it's a little overplayed because, again, I do think that he's trying to be likable and affable. He just doesn't even know how to do that. But, no, the biggest takeaway I have from this entire thing is, as I am one to do, I related to the media member. And congrats to that guy for getting out a halfway decent answer, because as soon as he puts that on you, you are, like, right next to him in the idiot factory. You are just standing side by side with him. And every one of your peers, by the way, too, in that situation, there's mostly writers.
Yeah.
Journalists. And this guy looked you dead in the eye, point blank, out of nowhere. You were just barely awake. You know, you didn't get to have your coffee this morning. You had to just rush on down to New Orleans Saints camp, and you're half awake, and you're like, oh God, I got a deadline, and you got a fight with your girlfriend, or, you know, your dog is sick, and it's the veterinarian bill is going to be a little bit more expensive than you thought it was going to be, and you're just not there. You're just holding a microphone in front of a coach's face because everything he's saying is really not all that consequential. Some of the reporters, many reporters go down to scrums, and they don't even think about questions. They just stick their mics in there, and they go, yep, everybody else do my work, please, and then I'll write something off of what you guys do. The good ones have an angle, and they go in there and they're like, yo, this is what I want to know about, and I'm going to retract, or I'm going to take out the pieces from what you say from the questions that I think are most pertinent to the audience and to me and to that perspective. A lot of people that are in scrums, they're just holding them. They're basically a microphone stand. It's just facts. They're holding the mic there and they're like, nobody talk to me. I'm too shy. I don't want to do it. I've been a microphone stand. When I first started going into scrums, I was like, I'm the question asker. And then you learn that's not who you want to be. You're brand new here. Nobody, excuse me. Wait just a moment. Yeah, that was not the approach. I wouldn't recommend that approach either. But yeah, if you're a microphone stand reporter, oof, hell, that's hell on earth. What's a metaphor? You're like, what, I'm in grade eight English? Grade seven English? You got to answer on the fly in front of all the journalists who are just staring at you? No one's bailing you out. You're in the world's worst form of Jeopardy. So no prizes. No prizes other than, way to go. You're not a complete idiot. So terrifying stuff. Terrifying stuff that Dennis Allen ended up putting on that poor reporter. Thank goodness they were able to muscle that one. He did. If you hear the clip, he has the Gather movies. Excuse me? Like, you heard me. Yeah,
that's a metaphor.
I know. Yeah, that was it. Anyways, what's next?
All right. So we're both TV guys.
Yeah.
Do you know about Ryan Murphy?
Who?
Ryan Murphy?
No. I'm assuming he's the guy that made the OJ show?
No, he made Glee.
Oh, no.
An American Horror Story.
Oh, the guy who made the new Aaron Hernandez show isn't the same guy that did the OJ? It's not the American Tale? I thought that he would have done that.
Maybe. It could be the same guy. I don't know who made the OJ one.
Anyways, I know American Horror Story. I've never seen Glee. I've never seen an episode of Glee. I know that The lady from Party Down is in it. The tall Jane something.
Jane Lynch?
Jane Lynch, yeah, yeah, she's in it. But, I like Jane Lynch.
He's basically making a anthology series, a 10-episode thing with FX about the Aaron Hernandez story. It's called Aaron Hernandez, NFL Star's Murder Conviction Comes to Light.
Yeah, Google to see if the same guy made the OJ one. Because sure. The OJ one was good. And the OJ one was...
That's with Cuba Gooding Jr.?
Yeah. Because that one was solid. And then they made another one of those, but I can't remember who about in that, like, American true horror story genre.
Yeah, he produced it.
Okay, so he did that one, and then what was the other one other than the OJ one?
That he did?
Yeah, I thought there was something else. Anyway, who cares? I liked the OJ one, even though I knew about the OJ story. And, you know, it was one of those things where boomers loved the OJ trial. Like, they were so into it. It was the trial of the century. And, yeah, like, my dad consumed it, like, so much. I still have memories of being a kid. And it's just like he had the 24-hour news channels on, just OJ content. And so I thought that show was just, like, fun, entertaining. It was, like, enough time had passed that... I thought it was kind of good for everybody. This is too soon to me, but maybe not. Maybe I'm just defensive because that happened when I was younger and it wasn't as long ago. Anyway, I don't know. But to me, the Aaron Hernandez thing has been done so much that it's like, what is out there? Plus, did you see the preview for it?
Yeah.
It looks like the world's worst acting, worst script writing. Like,
so that's Ryan Murphy, though. It's all camp. That's how he does it.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I've watched American Horror Story. It's a pretty damn good show.
Like, very camp.
It's pretty damn good. I don't think that the first couple of seasons of that were all camp like that. Like, this is corny. And also, when you're doing a story like this,
it's a little distasteful.
Yeah, I just think it's lame. And just from seeing some of the clips, the way that they're advertising it, the guy that they cast to be Aaron, anyway, the lines, when I'm on the football field, everything, I was like, ugh, really? Anyway, I've already done the Aaron Hernandez stuff. I read the Rolling Stone piece. I saw the documentary that Netflix put out on him probably like 4 or 5 years ago, which I also thought was pretty fast and loose with the facts to create certain narratives. I have no interest in the show. I think that if you're someone who didn't know the Aaron Hernandez story, right? Like, this is the kind of show that maybe you watch with your girlfriend because she's like, this really happened? And you're like, yeah. But I think everybody knows the story that's at least, you know, adjacent. This is a huge deal. It's a huge deal. Anyway, so I'm not into it. I couldn't care less. I think it looks lame. And yeah, I think that Aaron is a weird guy in the sense that, like, yeah, obviously, you know, monster and killed people. Awful. But he's a weird figure in the sense of, people will just say whatever about him and it just immediately becomes like true. Like, you can just run with it. Like, people just come out of the woodworks and they're like, yeah, this happened with Aaron Hernandez. And they're like, I guess so. Let's put it in the show.
Really?
Yes.
Jeez.
Yes. Yes. He is very much you can just say whatever you want about him and then it just kind of gets put into the, well, maybe this did happen or maybe this is the truth category. And I do find that a little strange. But anyways, keep it moving. What do we got?
Oh, yeah, just correction on that. It's called American Sports Story. Aaron,
yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so Charles Barkley went on the Dan Le Batard Show podcast, and he left a minimum of $100 million on the table to stay with Turner Sports. That's a big move. That's a lot of money.
Yeah. What's the question?
How much is loyalty worth to you in sports, like when it comes from an athlete or comes from a friend? Is it overrated, underrated?
It's definitely underrated. I think that this loyalty thing now, I guess my take on loyalty is it's entered a place where people view loyalty as you are a sucker. And that is not good. I don't think that that's a good thing societally, that we're moving into that zone, because like I saw two kids from Colorado State talking about why they didn't enter the transfer portal and get the $600,000 they could have gotten. And the quarterback of the team answers and says something along the lines of, It's not my job to, he's like, I'm going to worry about that later. It's not my primary goal as a 20-year-old college student to try and make hundreds of thousands of dollars. And instead of me going, damn, that's really mature and that's really cool, and that's a, like a different level of confidence, and also I think so, like a good upbringing, my first thought was immediately, what are you doing? What are you talking about? Go get that money. And what do we say now to everybody? Whenever they're asking for any kind of advice, it's always like, get the money, get the money, get the money. And it's like, there's way more important things. And no, loyalty does mean something, because you know it in your friendships. You know it in your direct relationships. Is when someone that you're close to and someone that you lean on, you know, betrays your trust in some way, it's the most crushing thing that can exist. And I do think that, you know, companies and organizations, that loyalty used to mean more. There was more of a... That meant something. Do I think that now you should be loyal without any type of give back? No. There needs to be reciprocity. And I think that, you know, you look at a lot of just like, say, jobs and job culture right now. I think that that's probably one that people are having a tough time reconciling with, because it's just like, oh, well, we replace you or we do this. And it's like, yeah, it's kind of keep the wheels of industry moving. And people go, yeah, don't give your life to the job, because, yeah, we've put a lot into job culture. Like, it's very different now than it was, you know, even 15, 20 years ago. But, yeah, I don't like that anytime someone is loyal now, outside of being married, because we're like, if you're loyal as a, in a marriage, people are like, that's good. We put a lot of... emphasis on that. We give that a lot of acclaim, but everything else, like you're loyal to a job, you're loyal to anything other than the dollar, when it comes down to that, and you're looked at as stupid immediately. That's the first thought that I think most people have, is don't be stupid, take the money. Without thinking like, hey, I'm loyal to this person because they were good to me and I should be good back to them. And that the next situation that you enter could end up being far worse. You could end up having that little bit more money, but you didn't take in the other considerations, and it does make things worse. And I think that that attitude does continue to spiral things out and does continue to have a deleterious effect on just about like everything we do. And so, yeah, I think it's cool that Charles Barkley, a guy who already has all the money, like he's not trying to be a robber baron. He's just trying to live a good life. He's already said he wants his kids to have to stake out their own path. He doesn't want to have to just leave them and let them be comfortable and live off of his money. That he feels a kinship with these other people that he does that broadcast with. And he understands that there are other people's jobs that are at stake with him being at TNT and doing that kind of a show. And that he's loyal to producers that help make his content and to... The staff that he works with on that show and to the network that gave him that platform and has always defended him and allowed him to become the full Charles Barkley on a network television show. So I think it's amazing. Like I laud him for it. It's a 10 out of 10 for me. I got no notes. Awesome stuff, Charles Barkley. Maybe you are a role model. Anyways, that was so lame.
There's context for that.
I was like cupping my own fart, smelling it, be like, oh, so good. You are a role model. Awful. Anyway, subscribe to the podcast. We'll see you tomorrow.